Could you start by telling me your name and where you were born?
My name is Joan Gillett. I was born in Victoria in 1924.
So you're from a BC family?
Yes.
Okay. And are you married?
Yes.
When did you marry?
19 years ago today.
Oh, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
So you were unmarried during the 1930s and 40s.
That's right.
And when did you begin to work?
1942.
And had you looked for work before that?
No.
Why did you decide to look for work?
I had completed 1 year of university and I wanted to go on to further university training, and it was necessary to get some money to do that.
Did you have difficulty finding a job?
No.
Where did you look for work?
My brother had just joined the Air Force and had left a job at the Dominion Bank, and I went into the Dominion Bank.
What were the conditions like at the bank? What kind of work did you do in?
I was a junior clerk, and I got $65 a month. The working conditions were not bad, although we were expected to work fairly long hours, helping to with the three balance days a month, and, you know, into the evening, and we didn't get paid any overtime or anything of that sort.
Was it mostly women who worked there, or was it mixed?
We were all temporary staff. All the junior staff were women at that point, but it was wartime, and we had taken over men's jobs temporarily. The bank at that time did not hire women on permanent staff.
So this was this the first time that women had actually entered the banking industry?
There was one woman there as a secretary who had started work during the First World War and had been kept on, but they were very rare.
Was there any discussion at all of organization then?
None at all.
Okay. After you worked at the bank, where did you then move on to?
I was offered a job in the assay office in the Department of Mines for the provincial government, again as a wartime replacement.
What year was that?
1943.
And can you describe the conditions and the wages there?
By that time I was getting at the bank $75 a month, and I went to the provincial government at exactly the same rate. The hours were 9 to 5 when 9 to 12:30 on Saturdays, but we got an hour and a quarter for lunch, so the hours weren't bad. The work was not particularly arduous. I was a lab assistant doing routine analysis of ores for strategic minerals. They were looking for ores that would be valuable in the war.
Do you remember why you decided to change jobs?
Oh yes, that was quite easy. That I was interested in science, and this was much more in keeping with the sort of work that I, at that point, hoped to go into.
And was that the case with many young women at that time, that they would look for opportunities in terms of wartime employment that they might not be able to get otherwise?
Well, of course, the whole thinking of the nation was geared toward winning the war, and you'd step into anything that would be helpful in that effort.
Right. So there was a real feeling of sort of patriotism at that time?
Oh, certainly, yes.
What kind of things did people do to support the war effort? Were there any special things that were done through the workplace to support, like bond drives, for example?
Yes, that was about the only thing that I can think of, though. I can't remember when we started the blood donor clinics. That was probably around the same time, but those were the main two things, the blood donor clinics and the buying bonds.
And was this a permanent job that you had?
No.
No, it was temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And how was it described as temporary? Did they tell you that you were going to be working there until the people whose jobs you had taken returned from the war?
That's right.
And was most of the workforce female at that time? In this particular
About half and half, I guess.
And
older men and females.
And did the women who worked there, were they mostly young or older, or were they married or single? Do you remember any of that?
Mostly young, single women. Yeah.
Did you live with your family at that time?
Yes.
Right. And did you have responsibilities around the home in terms of housework? And
no.
Okay. Did you help to support your family with your wages?
My father died just about then, and that's why I kept on working rather than going back to university as I had planned to do. It was necessary that I help to support my mother and that I support myself.
Right. And was this the job you had when you first became interested in organization?
Yes. As a lab assistant, I was. I became the. Was called then a departmental representative, which was more or less analogous to a shop steward for the Department of Mines. And at that point, we weren't didn't have checkoff, and I used to go around and collect the monthly fees from everybody.
Can you
turn them into the union office?
Can you describe the process by which you became interested in the the association at that point?
I was talked into it by one of the older men in the department who was anxious to get somebody else besides himself interested in working on the association, and I became reasonably interested in it. It was kind of a different sort of thing to do, you know, and I became vice president of the Victoria branch of the association almost by default, because at 9:30 I was attending a meeting and they had no nominations in for vice president, and they had to be in by midnight of that night, and somebody taught me into it. And really my major interest started from that time on.
Do you remember the kind of issues that drew you into interest in the association at all?
Kind of issues.
How did he talk you into it?
My interest really began at the point where the war was over, and my job was no longer secure. You know, the men were coming back, and I got a job. I transferred within the mines department into the filing office. And it was obvious that we needed a union, that our working conditions were inferior, particularly women's working conditions. Not so much in that they paid equal money for equal work, but the equal work wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
There were just no opportunities for advancement for women, unless they had particular skills, mainly in social work or some definite field that women were accepted in. Of course, we weren't the only people discriminated against. At the time that I was hired, they didn't hire anybody other than Caucasians. There's a large Chinese population in Victoria. None of them were hired in the civil service until well after the war.
Was that like unwritten policy? Or?
Yes. There was nothing written that precluded women from higher administrative jobs or anything of that sort, but they never got them.
So there was no legislation, for example, against married women taking certain kinds of positions? Because there was in the federal public service.
I can't recall that there were any.
Yeah. So you had gone from having essentially a technical technician's job to a filing kind of position?
Yes.
And did you feel that that was in a way sort of coming down in terms of your job aspirations, the kinds of hopes you'd had for developing an understanding of science? And
my experience in the assay office had lessened my enthusiasm for a career in science. And I was uncertain as to what role I wanted to do, but I knew it was something more connected with people than that sort of ivory tower scientist existence. I wasn't sure, you know, what I wanted to do until I became really interested in the union work, and that seemed a field that satisfied my ambitions, really, more than the job satisfaction. The job was a pleasant enough one in the filing office. After a couple of years there, I was in charge of it with a staff of four people under me, and it was very, very pleasant work.
Right. In what ways did the union work fill your ambitions in terms of being able to, you know, do, I guess, social kinds of work with people? Can you talk about that a little bit?
The civil service mentality at that time was very difficult to deal with. The association, as it was then called, not a union, was called an association because the people weren't willing to accept total concept of unionization. Mm-hmm. They were not a union. We had a lot of older people, a lot of young girls who, unlike myself, were not interested in fighting for union rights. And it was mainly in that field that there was satisfaction for me in selling this as a concept to the people I was working with, to show them that a straight person such as myself really felt that we had to get in there and fight. That it wasn't enough to accept the paternalistic sort of handouts that we got from the government, that just because this was made a fairly soft job, didn't mean that, you know, we had to be quiet about everything and accept all these easy things. I very much resented the sort of things that they would hand us, like long holidays at Christmas. We'd get an extra day more than anybody else, you see. And the people would all say, oh, what a soft touch those civil servants have, you know, nothing. Government employees, they don't work hard at all. Whereas we had to show them that we were willing to accept labor conditions. Mm-hmm. And it was selling that idea to all the rest of my fellow workers there that was challenging and rewarding, I think.
Did the government tend to foster an attitude that because you were civil servants, it was a service kind of occupation, that you were serving taxpayers, and that because of that you shouldn't push for your rights as workers? Was there that kind of attitude?
There was something of the same sort of attitude as there was during the war, that you were being disloyal to your country, to your king, as it then was, if you made waves at all, as far as labor rights were concerned.
And did that continue in the post-war period as well?
Yes, but I think that the union did a lot to break that sort of feeling down, without totally being against it, because who can be against loyalty to one's country or one's province or anything of that sort?
Right. When did the organization of the association begin?
Prior to my time, just a few years. And my sister had been working at the Parliament buildings before that. She had joined, not quite at the beginning. My cousin had been in it, I guess right from the start. But I knew all of those people who had started it. They were still very active at the time that I came in.
So was your family a family that was supportive of trade unionism?
No.
No.
My sister got her job at the buildings as political, under political patronage. As most people did in those days.
And how did people see the relationship between political patronage and organizing an association or a union?
they didn't really look at it much. You know, you worked with the system as it was. And that's why I say that my major job, or what I saw as my major job, was raising people's consciousness as to what rights they did have, and that you weren't being a terribly pushy person to expect your rights.
Did you try and argue for people to be autonomous from whichever party was in government at that time as civil servants? Because I would imagine that patronage could be a really serious problem in terms of seniority and a whole series of questions that would be negotiating issues for a trade union. I'm just wondering how you would get around that.
I don't know that we got around it, really. We worked with what was there.
Mm-hmm.
And when the system was collective begging, that's the sort of thing we did.
How organized was the BC Government Employees Association when you first became organized? How many workers did it have under its, I suppose, its wing? And at what stage was the organization?
There were a few hundred members in Victoria. There were something over 1,000 members in the province. I can remember quite clearly just shortly before I left that there were over 1,000 members in Victoria and that there were 10,000 members in the province. It had gone up to that in the 15 years that I'd been there.
Were you involved in organizing?
No. No. Other than to sign up members within my own department.
Right. But there was sort of an organizing drive going on over those years? Or?
Well, just through the departmental representatives. That's right. How it was done.
Is that how the union spread to more and more people?
Yes.
Did the civil service grow also in that period? Or?
Yes.
So that in part accounts for the...
Yeah, the main reason the association grew that much was that we had a medical services plan under the union. And to get into it, you had to be a member of the union. And lots of people joined just for that.
So how did you go about negotiating contracts? Was the association recognized by the employer?
Yes.
How did you win recognition?
Just by going and talking to the cabinet. We presented briefs to the cabinet. And during the early years when I was in it, they were established by consent as the bargaining agent for the civil service. And they made direct representations to the Civil Service Commission on wages. But it was really the cabinet that had to be convinced of the necessity for further funds. And it got to the point during the course of that 15 years where the cabinet would decide on how much money was to be allotted to civil servants' wages, and the association and the Civil Service Commission worked it out between them as to how these funds were to be allotted.
Right. So were medical benefits part of the issues that were negotiated in this process?
No. Medical benefits, the association rather hated to lose them. The government just took them over as an arbitrary thing. The reason they hated to lose them was because that was a good tool for getting membership in the association. But they at the same time gave us a voluntary check-off scheme, and which they later took away again. But that did help us keep some of the bulk of our members in.
What were the other issues that were negotiated in the contract? Were there written contracts?
No.
It was all sort of word of mouth agreement? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Superannuation was a big issue, and we changed the Total Superannuation Act. I was on that committee, and so I'm quite familiar with that one. Various other working conditions regarding temporary staff, conditions in some of the institutions, which were particularly bad, were discussed and negotiated on a collective begging basis, you know. Our big issue in my day, of course, was a collective agreement and recognition as a union. We were planned to go on strike for a collective bargaining agreement. And at the last minute, the government offered us Chief Justice Sloan as a one-man commission to make a report on bargaining rights for BC government employees. And we accepted that because that had been a proposal in the previous year at our convention as a step toward getting bargaining rights. And we had the verbal agreement of Mr. Bennett and all of his cabinet that whatever Chief Justice Sloan recommended, they would in turn recommend to the next session of the legislature. And it was just shortly after that that we accepted that, called off the strike.
What year was that?
1957, okay. Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Then they appointed, gave Justice Sloan some juicy government appointment so that he had to withdraw from doing that. And with the association's agreement, they appointed in his place Professor Carruthers from UBC. And that, of course, delayed the report being made. And it was completed the following year, and they never made it public. It wasn't made public until the NDP took office.
So that put, what kind of effect did that have on the association?
They went on a one-day strike, and they took out an injunction against them about picketing public places, and that effectively killed the strike. We were very, very dubious about whether that strike would have come off in the first place had we actually called it, because there, Victoria was the weak part of the union. There is a feeling among the civil service there that you're right under the gun. And I was sure that I was going to be fired at that point, because I was at that time first vice president of the provincial body, and I was sure they were going to fire the ringleaders. But the strike was settled without us being fired. But it was such a terrible feeling throughout the buildings. The people who had been ready to go on strike and the ones who were, you know, quite determined to break it. And from the ministerial level on down, though, there was this awful dissension, this terrible feeling of not trusting one another. And just an example of the sort of thing that was going on, I was, as I told you, in charge of this little filing office. The minister called me in to ask me about some phase of our filing system, and I explained how it was done, and he said, well, that doesn't seem like a very sensible way of doing it. And I said, but the deputy minister wants it done that way. And he said, well, change it, but don't tell the deputy minister that I told you. So being a loyal civil servant, I went to the deputy minister and said, this is what the minister has told me to do. And he said, don't do it, but don't tell him I told you not to. And I thought, you know, I can't stand this. This is ridiculous. Why work in a place like this, you know? So I quit. Because I'd thought through, you know, what would I do if they fired me? And I decided that I would go into teaching at that point.
The minister was the government, the elected official, and the mm-hmm. deputy minister is the chief civil servant.
Yeah.
So you have, and
so it was that kind of divided loyalty. You see, even the top echelon of the employed civil servants were not loyal to the social credit government. And this sort of at loggerheads. You know, we'd be going in to see the cabinet about wage increases or any other phase of negotiations, and the premier would promise us something. I'd come out from that, and people would say, well, what did he say? And I'd say, well, this is what he told us. Well, do you think we'll really get it? That was always the question. Do you think we'll really get it? You know, and if you can't trust the word of the premier of the province, who can you trust, you see? So, you know, it's sort of sickening.
Was it particularly difficult to maintain an association or a union in conditions where you were in direct contact with your employer, the kind of small office situation where there's a lot of pressure, where you're working in Parliament and you're dealing with the government constantly? Was that something that people felt all the time in terms of pressures on them? And
mm-hmm. It was much more difficult. The union was never as strong in Victoria as elsewhere in the province, where they were, you know, they didn't see the minister from one year's end to the next. We ate in the same cafeteria as the minister. We, you know.
Did they do any particular kinds of things to increase the pressure on people who worked in that kind of close contact with them?
They just acted naturally. No, they didn't do any thing from the point of view of trying to increase pressure on us. I'm sure that in their own thinking they thought they treated us very well. And their main aim was to keep costs as low as possible. Mm-hmm. To not be... they want votes. And the number of civil servants you have don't get your votes. You want money to spend on other things than civil servants increases. That'll never get you a vote.
So did that mean that one of the big issues was the question of layoffs and employment?
No.
Seniority?
No. That was one of the difficult things in organizing the union, is that people felt fairly secure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of civil servants do not have skills that they can sell anywhere else. So they wanted to keep their jobs secure, and they wanted to keep things cool and nobody to notice them.
So people were afraid of being fired for union activity? Or?
I don't know of anyone that was fired from union by reason of union activity. But there were certainly people who didn't get promotions that they should have had, that they were in line for. There were areas of government employee that were declared redundant. Mm-hmm. Nobody lost their job on that account, but they were reassigned somewhere else, and it could have been at a lower pay because there wasn't a job in that same category available. But nobody was ever fired from the civil service, you see, so there was always that much security.
Right. Were women active in the union?
Not to the extent that they should have been.
Okay, maybe starting there. Why is that, do you think?
I think this is, you know, going back to the same old traditional thing, that they were just not as interested in a long-term career, and therefore they didn't have the same vested interest as a man did. I think this is broken down to a certain extent now, when the majority of women, married women in our part of the world, work.
Right.
But at that time they didn't, the time that...
So where were women located within the workforce in the civil service? What kind of jobs did they have?
Oh, secretarial mainly and clerical.
Were most of those temporary?
No, they were all permanent jobs.
Okay. And were... what was the age range of the women who were employed there?
As broad as... There were quite a few older women, particularly in some clerical fields. Motor vehicle branch had a lot of women working in it. The library branch had a lot of women. A lot of older women who had been widowed or divorced or something of that sort, who had then to find a job without any particular skills for the job market. And they were easy targets for the, you know, keeping their wages down and whatnot, because they desperately needed the work.
Right. Were there many married women who worked there?
At the time I started, no. By the time I left, I would say about half of them were married, probably. Marked change.
Did many women come in from the war industries into the government employment after the war?
Not noticeably, no.
Okay. And did women who worked during the war generally stay within the civil service? Or did they lose their jobs at the end of the war?
Trying to think of the ones I knew. Most of them went on somewhere else. Some of them got married. I guess that's what happened to most of them. Most of them got married.
Were there layoffs after when the war ended and men came back?
In the mines department, which is the only one I'm intimately familiar with, there were no layoffs. They were all accommodated somewhere, or they left of their own free will. A couple of them went back to university, as I had planned to do. A couple of them got married to returning servicemen.
Were women asked to leave the jobs that they had had temporarily, though?
Well, I was offered this job in the filing office.
So did the government actually sort of go on some kind of a campaign to relocate women who had...
No.
Did the union try and encourage women to become active within it?
Yes. We had a couple of special meetings aimed strictly at the women in Victoria. One of them was quite successful. Dr. Anderson, a woman, came and spoke to us about that women's role. But in general, there were just a handful of us who were really active as women.
Were those women younger women or single women? Were they the people who were most dependent on their jobs?
They were almost all older than I was. And more than half of them, I guess, were divorced or widowed, who were now looking to a full-time, you know, lifetime career from the government employee.
What kind of discussions would the women have about issues that they would want to see perhaps raised within a union contract? Was there discussion of equal work or equal pay?
Equal opportunity was the